If you listen to pop culture news, one phrase comes up a lot: cultural appropriation. The phrase has become a staple in the media.
Cultural appropriation.
Cultural appropriation.
Cultural appropriation.
Kim is being accused of blackfishing and cultural appropriation.
But as often as we hear the phrase, it doesn't seem to be clearly defined.
Cultural appropriation is when someone adopts a culture that isn't their own and does not acknowledge or respect the culture being used for their own benefit.
Appropriation occurs when a style leads to racist generalizations or stereotypes where it originated, but is deemed as high fashion, cool, or funny when the privileged take it for themselves.
With all of this talk about this behavior, what is cultural appropriation? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing: the truth. Welcome to Red Pilled America. Cultural appropriation is a phrase that's so widely used by the media that it's become a given that it exists. In fact, it's so established that it's created offshoot behaviors.
There's an alarming new trend making national headlines that needs to be addressed: blackfishing. So, blackfishing is when a non-black person pretends to be black on their social media by culturally appropriating black features in an attempt to gain followers and attention.
But as frequently as the phrase is used, the definition attached to cultural appropriation doesn't seem to match the phenomenon we're all witnessing. So what is it?
To find the answer, we're going to tell the story of a time that your humble co-host was accused of cultural appropriation, then take a journey to the roots of the phrase. As with many things we hear in the news, cultural appropriation may describe an actual behavior, but it's not the one the media's peddling.
At the end of this story, we want your opinion. Who was right, Adriana or me? It isn't popular when a man tells a woman how to dress, so I'm starting off this whole endeavor with a bit of a handicap, because that's what I once did with Adriana. She's easily the most fashionable woman I've ever met, but on this one occasion, I stepped in to tell her what, or actually, what not to wear. It was a Sunday early evening in May 1993, and I was on my way with a group of friends to Adriana's house in West Covina. We were all going to a concert.
And the band was The Diggable Planets. They'd just released the hit track, The Rebirth of Slick, better known to most as Cool Like That. The song was a cut, and I loved it. But truth be told, I knew very little about the band members other than it was comprised of three people, two guys and a girl. I knew nothing about their backgrounds, and frankly, I didn't care. What was there to know? They had a funky, fresh hit, and I was going to go see them perform.
Now, fashion played a big role in our lives at the time, and my crew of guys had a particular look. Our uniform consisted of baggy jeans and a tight 50s polyester shirt we'd pick up at one of the vintage clothing shops on Melrose in Hollywood. We'd close it out with a custom-stitched baseball cap and some Nike sneakers. The ensemble wasn't a mainstream fashion trend, but it was our own look. We didn't have much money, so we had to get creative to stand out, and this look did the trick. Adriana had a much wider palette, so I didn't ever really know what to expect from her.
We were young and in love, and I always made an effort to look extra cute on our dates. I really wanted to wear something that would knock Patrick's socks off, something that he'd never seen me wear before. That meant I needed a new outfit. So, the week leading up to the concert, I planned on hitting up the local mall to buy something that would make me look funky fresh, dressed to impress, ready to party. But I was busy with school, homework, and a full-time job. Before I knew it, it was the morning before the Diggable Planets concert, and I still didn't have anything new to wear. I woke up that Sunday morning determined to get something new that day. Problem was, I didn't have a lot of money. But then I remembered that Judy's was going out of business and having an everything must go sale. Judy's was a trendy retail chain of the time that sold super cute women's wear and accessories. I always liked shopping there, but most of the time it was slightly out of my budget. But with this going on a business sale, I was sure to find the perfect outfit for the concert. So I hopped into my vintage 320i and headed to the mall. As I drove, I daydreamed about showing my friends all the cute things I bought at Judy's. I got this skirt, this dress, two pairs of earrings, yada yada yada, and all for $40. I pulled up to the mall and walked into Judy's with dreams of fashion euphoria dancing in my head. But the dreams soon became a dystopian nightmare. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. The place looked ransacked. Sort of like BLM had just peacefully protested through the joint and confiscated all the good stuff. It was slim pickings. After making several rounds in the store, it was clear that there wasn't one single item of clothing that would work for me. So in desperation, I headed over to the last frontier, the accessories area. And that's when I spotted it. Cream-colored crochet hat of sorts. It was beautiful, delicate and feminine, yet still edgy. It had that bohemian chic vibe that I liked so much. So I tried it on, and it was much more fitted than I had anticipated. It was basically a skull cap. I'd have to do something about my poofy curly hair to make it work, but it wasn't anything a little gel couldn't handle. I made my way over to the cash register to make the purchase.
It'll be $37.89.
$37? I asked in bewilderment. I mean, this thing was tiny, and that seemed like a whole lot of money for what it was. I tried making a joke to hide my sticker shock.
The loincloth of a small man is 10 times the size of this thingamajiggy.
It's $37.89.
I stood there for a second thinking about it. But then the girl behind me said,
I'll take it if you don't want it.
And that's when I knew what I had to do. No, I'm getting it. Here you go. I smiled as I handed the cashier two $20 bills. It cleaned me out, but I convinced myself that I couldn't miss out on this amazing opportunity. This was an item that was clearly in high demand. And this sort of kind of a hat from Judy's was on sale. Practically a steal, I said to myself. I rushed home from Judy's to get ready because Patrick would be picking me up soon, and per usual, I was running late. I just knew that he was gonna love my new fitted hat. I didn't have a lot of time, so I needed to work quickly. Since the hat was crocheted, it had small areas where you'd be able to see my hair underneath. I have curly hair, which tends to frizz easily, especially when it's hot and humid, sort of like it is inside of a concert venue. I had to make sure that my hair didn't start wiggling its way out of the crochet holes and make me look like some lunatic who'd stuck her finger in a light socket. So I took a big glob of my brother's gel. He used the kind of stuff that turned hair into rock. And I slicked my hair back into a low ponytail. I thought I sort of looked like one of those babes from Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love video. For extra measure, I generously sprayed extra strong holding hairspray. Then I put on my new cute hat from Judy's. I was so pleased with my look for the night, I couldn't wait for my boyfriend to see it. Perfect timing. Patrick had arrived to pick me up. I enthusiastically opened the door, then stood there with a big grin on my face, waiting for him to shower me with compliments about how cute I looked.
My mouth dropped. Adriana's cute hat was a kufi. For those that aren't familiar with the term, a kufi is a brimless skullcap. It's often rounded to the contour of your cranium, crocheted, and covers the top portion of the head. The thing may have looked like just a form-fitted beanie, but it had other cultural meaning. In America, kufis are known as African headdresses for men, and in particular, Muslim men. Now, this was a problem. At the time in the early 90s, there was a big movement happening in black music. An offshoot of the Nation of Islam had infiltrated hip-hop. They called themselves the Five Percenters. The The Five Percenters were and are a black nationalist religious sect that follows a form of Islam that believes that 85% of the people live in economic and psychological oppression, 10% of people are the white elites that keeps the truth from the 85% in order to control them, and the remaining 5% are an enlightened group of blacks tasked with awakening the 85%. They are the Five Percenters. It was an aggressive movement, and many of the hip-hop artists of the time incorporated these Islamic beliefs into their lyrics. Groups like Public Enemy, The Poor Righteous Teachers, Busta Rhymes, and Brand Nubian aligned their music with this movement. The Five Percenters saturated the early 1990s hip-hop community. The band that Adriana and I were going to go see were not openly Five Percenters, but because of the prominence of this movement in hip-hop at the time, the Diggable Planets would no doubt attract a fair amount of this Islamic crowd to their concert. So when I saw Adriana wearing what many would think was a traditionally Islamic headdress, my first thought was, big mistake. So I said to Adriana, "You're not wearing that kufi to the concert, are you?"
"What's a kufi?"
"What do you have on your head?"
"This is from Judy's. It's not a kufi, whatever that is."
"You can't wear that to the Diggable Planets concert, honey."
"Excuse me?" It was very much a, "Oh no, he didn't" moment. I could not believe it. He had another thing coming if he thought for one second that he could control what I was or wasn't going to wear. "Yeah, I'm wearing this. It's cute and I like it. I don't care if you, or anybody else for that matter, doesn't like it, because I like it. I got it from Judy's." Patrick tried in vain to convince me not to wear the hat, but the more he talked, the angrier I became. Who the hell does this guy think he is? I paid good money for this hat, $37, and I'm wearing it. He gave me some cockamamie spiel about there possibly being a lot of Muslims people at the concert, and they likely wouldn't like me wearing a kufi. "It's not a kufi. I got it at Judy's," I yelled at him. After several minutes of fighting me, he realized this was not an argument he was going to win, and he gave up.
I mean, listen, I agreed with Adriana. She should have been able to wear whatever she wanted. We live in America. But I thought of it like wearing an all-red outfit to a party thrown by the Crips, who wear all blue and view the red-wearing Bloods as their mortal enemy. It may just be a color, but it's a color that'll get you killed. Adriana insisted that it was not a kufi. It was just a hat she got from Judy's. And when it came to fashion, I didn't and don't have much to say in what Adriana wears. She wasn't taking it off. So I thought, maybe this was going to be one of those times where you smile and let someone learn from experience. So we jumped in my VW Golf and headed out to Hollywood.
It was a tense drive to the concert. I couldn't get over the fact that I'd been bamboozled into dating a male chauvinist. This is a dead end. There's no future with this guy, I thought to myself. I'd have to beat the misogyny right out of him if this relationship was going to work. As we got closer to the concert, the mood started to lighten as the excitement for the show started to settle in.
The concert was at a famed place called The Palace, which was once an old TV studio from the 1960s. It had since been converted to a live venue that fit about 1,500 people. As we walked up to the show, I'd be lying if I didn't say that I was a bit on edge. What most young women don't really grasp is that when they cause turmoil in the public, it often escalates to violence because their boyfriend has to get involved. And at the time, I was not exactly the most even-tempered young man. A year earlier, I shut down a concert when rapper Marky Mark, better known today as Mark Wahlberg, pulled Adriana up on stage. That night, Adriana was wearing a sexy bustier, and Marky Mark fell in love with her at first sight. Within a few seconds, I caused a violent scene and shut down the concert. Now it was just 1 year later, and once again a piece of Adriana's clothing had the potential to create trouble. You see, I was no stranger to the Muslim community, A few of the guys in our crew were actually Muslims, and they were some of the nicest, most peaceful people I'd ever met. But the 5%ers were something different, especially if a non-believer was wearing something that they viewed as sacred. Black nationalism mixed with the aggression of the time did not make for a peaceful combo. And I knew they weren't going to like Adriana, a Mexican, wearing a kufi. The concert started at 8 p.m. We got there a little early, and the crowd was just starting to trickle in. We made our way over to the bar, and as we did, I began scanning the crowd looking for possible 5%er cliques that could be problematic. We'd been there maybe 10 minutes, just long enough to start dancing to the music the DJ was spinning, when it happened. A guy walked up to Adriana and asked, "Are you Muslim?"
I should have looked at the guy and said, "Assalamu alaikum," and kept it moving. But in true AJ style, I went with the sass instead. "Not that it's any of your business, but I'm Catholic. You want me to say an Our Father for you?" I responded.
It was clear the guy didn't like her response, and he was there with a few others who looked on. All I could think was, here we go. "If you're not a Muslim, then you shouldn't be wearing that kufi," the guy snapped back.
"It's not a kufi. I got it at Judy's." I could see Patrick in my peripheral view shaking his head.
What Adriana was being accused of in that moment was what we know today as cultural appropriation, and it was a concept that had recently made its way out of the college campuses and onto the street. The phrase cultural appropriation is actually thought to have been first used in a 1945 essay by American literature professor Arthur E. Christie. He used it to describe how Western civilization writers were taking some of the mysticism found in, quote, Oriental literature and infusing it within their work. But the idea didn't gain a wide audience until the early 1970s.
"Say that those nominated for the best performance by an actor are..."
"Marlon Brando in The Godfather. The winner is... Marlon Brando in The Godfather."
At the 1973 Academy Awards, a global audience was introduced to a movement that was in the making.
"Hello, my name is Sasheen Littlefeather. I'm Apache, and I'm president of the National Native American Affirmative Image Committee. I'm representing Marlon Brando this evening, and he has asked me to tell you in a very long speech, which I cannot share with you presently because of time, but I will be glad to share with the press afterwards, that he very regretfully cannot accept this very generous award. And the reasons for this being are the treatment of American Indians today by the film industry..." Excuse me. "And on television in movie reruns, and also with recent happenings at Wounded Knee. I beg at this time that I have not intruded upon this evening, and that we will, in the future, our hearts and our understandings will meet with love and generosity. Thank you on behalf of Marlon Brando."
Actor Marlon Brando had a history of taking up social causes, but never on the Oscar stage. Now he was using his platform to argue that the Hollywood colonizers were profiting from creating negative images of Native Americans. It was the beginnings of the cultural appropriation argument. Later in the night, actor Clint Eastwood presented the award for Best Picture when he decided to take a jab at Brando's stunt.
"I don't know if I should present this award on behalf of all the cowboys shot in all the John Ford westerns over the years."
By the mid-1970s, British artist and art historian Kenneth Coates Smith helped evolve the concept of cultural appropriation in an essay entitled Some General Observations on the Problem of Cultural Colonialism. In it, he melds colonialism with the Marxist concept of class appropriation, where the elites appropriate art from the lower class, then redefined it as high culture. The result was what he termed cultural colonialism. In this process, Kenneth Coates Smith argued that the bourgeois acquired the cultural property of the lower class to perpetuate their privileged class. This argument that certain things can be the property of another culture is one that would come into play in the decades that followed. He argued that further research and analysis was needed in this area. Academics further developed this concept in the 1980s, but even as late as 1987, the term cultural appropriation hadn't yet made its way into the Random House Dictionary of the English language. However, behind the scenes, American Indians were developing the narrative underpinning the concept, and they were about to go after some low-hanging fruit.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So as late as 1987, the term cultural appropriation hadn't yet made its way into the Random House Dictionary of the English language. However, behind the scenes, American Indians were developing the narrative underpinning the concept, and they were about to go after some low-hanging fruit. Enter Suzanne Schoen Harjo, a poet and Native American rights activist. In the 1980s, Harjo began an effort to pressure the NFL franchise, known at the time as the Redskins, to drop its name, claiming American Indian symbols were the cultural property of her people that should not be appropriated by non-Native Americans. She also felt that Redskins was a racist term that had life or death implications for her people. In a 2001 speech, she highlighted the problem.
Our Native teenagers have the highest rate of suicide and suicide attempts in the United States of any segment of American society, bar none. Part of that comes from low self-esteem, and part of that comes from this bombardment of negative images and belittling and being written out of history and written wrongly about and presented in stereotypic ways. So our very humanity is in question. That's one reason we want all of this eliminated, not just the R word, although that's an excellent start. We want all the Native images eliminated from sports. In the 1960s, when this movement began, there were over 3,000 of these Native references in schools across the country. Now there are fewer than 1,500. That's a tremendous gain in fewer than 30 years.
So, in the 1980s, Harjo tried meeting with the then-owner of the Redskins, a guy named Jack Kent Cook, but she had no luck. The team's earlier name was the Indian-themed Boston Braves, but the city had a baseball team with the same name. As the story goes, he changed the name to the Boston Redskins to retain the team's Indian imagery and honor their coach, who identified as a Native American. The team would later move to Washington, D.C. The word Redskin even appeared to come from the Native Americans themselves. According to a Smithsonian linguist, 18th century European settlers appeared to have adopted the term from Native Americans who referred to themselves as Redskins. Also, the Redskin head logo at the time was created by Walter Blackie Wetzel, the one-time president of the National Congress of American Indians. The 1980s owner of the Redskins felt there was no malice in the name and logo and wouldn't meet with Harjo. The issue went quiet until the early 1990s, when Harjo got a call.
A young lawyer from Minnesota named Stephen Baird, who worked with a law firm named Dorsey & Whitney, called up and asked if I would meet with him. He had done a Lexis search, and my name kept popping up on this issue. So my name popped up here and there, and Steve Baird wanted to interview me for his law journal article about the U.S. Patent and Trademark Board Lanham Act.
The Lanham Act is a 1940 statute that governs whether a trademark is or isn't registered by the federal government.
So, eventually we got together, and he asked me two questions. The first was, why did you reject the U.S. Patent and Trademark Board as a forum for getting rid of this name? I said, well, we didn't know about it, actually. Hadn't thought about it. Tell me more. And he said, well, why did you reject the Lanham Act as a cause of action? I said, I don't know what the Lanham Act is. Tell me more. And it basically has a four-prong test. Does something, an image or a name, hold a group or another person up to ridicule? Does it hold people up to contempt? Is it disparaging? Is it scandalous? So, by the end of his taking me to school on the law, I asked him if he would be my lawyer in the matter. And he said yes, and we went on from there.
So in 1992, Harjo, along with a group of Native Americans, filed a petition to the United States Patent and Trade Office requesting all of the Redskins' trademarks be revoked. Stunningly, in April 1999, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office sided with Harjo, finding that the name was disparaging to Native Americans. The board ordered the cancellation of 7 Redskins trademarks, including the team's name and Indian head logo. But the fight was just getting started. At the time, the Redskins came under new ownership. Businessman Dan Snyder purchased the team for a reported $750 million. It was a record amount at the time, and he wasn't about to let the name of his prize go. He cited the history of the name and logo and the tradition of the team. Snyder vowed to keep the name. He appealed the decision, and in 2003, a federal judge overturned the 1999 ruling revoking the Redskins' trademark. The judge found that there was, quote, insufficient evidence to conclude that the name was disparaging to American Indians. But Harjo and her team continued to press the issue. They filed an appeal, and in 2005, the D.C. Court of Appeals revived the case, giving Harjo another chance to prove the Redskins' trademarks was disparaging to American Indians. In a seemingly coordinated effort, later that year, the American Psychological Association issued a finding.
The American Psychological Association came out and said there needs to be an immediate ban and abolishment of Native American mascots because it has been proven to harm the mental health and stability of kids, and not just Native kids, but all kids.
But ultimately, the appeals court decided that Harjo and her co-plaintiffs had waited too long to file their suit, using the legal doctrine known as latches. So Harjo and her group pressed the case to the highest court, and in 2009, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case, leaving the lower court's decision to stand. The issue seemed to come to a conclusion. That is, until 2013, when a young group of American Indians trying to avoid the latches issue faced by Harjo's case filed a new lawsuit, again petitioning to strip the Redskins' federal trademark rights. The Redskins had to start the process all over.
That's when the media began putting their finger on the scale. The far left, Slate Magazine, announced they'd no longer be referring to the Redskins by their name. Instead, they'd call them the Washington, D.C. football team. The New Republic, Mother Jones, the Washington City Paper, the Kansas City Star, and football writers at the Buffalo News and Philadelphia Daily News followed suit. Protesters took to the stadiums to amp up the pressure.
We're here to help the Washington team to get an education. They need to learn that Indian mascots and logos are harmful to all of our children, and it's time to remove this kind of stereotyping from our society.
At the time, in 2013, America was in the throes of a new racial tension, and the person that helped instigate the turmoil stepped in to give his 2 cents on the Redskins' name issue.
Obviously, people get pretty attached to team names, mascots. You know, I don't think there are any Redskins fans that mean offense.
President Obama was about to make the issue go nuclear.
I've got to say, if I were the owner of the team, and I knew that there was a name of my team, even if it had a storied history that was offending a sizable group of people, I'd think about changing it. You know, I think all these mascots and team names related to Native Americans, Native Americans feel pretty strongly about it. And I don't know whether our attachment to a particular name should override the real legitimate concerns that people have about these things.
The comments sent the media into overdrive.
Even President Obama has weighed in, saying he thinks the name should be changed.
The way to gauge if it's offensive or not, right, is to walk into a bar full of Native Americans and yell out, Redskins, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be beaten up near to near death, right? So it's offensive.
If it's offensive, and it clearly is offensive to a group of people, I mean, you've got to look at changing it.
Feeling the pressure, NFL leadership decided to take an action.
The NFL is now 8 weeks into its season, and pressure continues to mount on the Washington Redskins to change their name, which many consider racist. This week, there's a big meeting between the NFL and an angry tribal nation.
After tribal leaders first requested a meeting with league officials in early October, Redskins owner Dan Snyder issued a letter to fans, calling the name part of the football team's heritage. He writes, "I respect the feelings of those who are offended by the team name, but I hope such individuals also try to respect what the name means." Snyder also says he has the support of 90% of Native Americans.
The name of our team is the name of our team, and it represents honor, it represents pride, it represents respect.
Change the name!
Change the name!
Snyder, who bought the franchise in 1999, has long resisted calls to alter the name, claiming it honors Native American heritage, even telling USA Today in 2013, quote, "We'll never change the name. It's that simple. Never. You can use caps."
In his mind, he believes he's never going to change the nickname. But the world around him is starting to cave in.
Other teams across the country with controversial mascots will likely be impacted by what happens with the Redskins.
When Washington's name changes, I think these others will be examined and looked at. And I think one by one, dominoes will fall.
And that prediction would prove to be prescient, as the Redskins owner was fielding a constant barrage of attacks, both in the media and by American Indian protesters at their games. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office made their decision on the second case challenging the validity of the Redskins' trademarks.
It might be time for the Washington Redskins to start brainstorming new team names. The U.S. Patent Office canceling the team's trademarks today, saying the Redskins' name is disparaging to Native Americans.
Dan Snyder saw that, and even he saw the writing on the wall that went with it. At some point, a trademark he needs for his business, a business worth hundreds of millions of dollars, is going to expire. And unless things change dramatically, the office is not going to grant him a new one.
You think about it, the team makes a lot of money off licensing the use of their name and their logo on merchandise and in other ways. If this decision stands and the federal court does not intervene and change the outcome, then that money that they're getting from the use of all of their name and the merchandise and so forth, that will dry up. That would be very, very expensive to the team.
But there are all kinds of companies, schools, products, that kind of thing, with similar names. What does this mean for them?
So if you have a name like this, and you're a school, you're a ski resort like Squaw Valley, for example, you are going to be concerned about this ruling if, number one, you've registered as a trademark your name. Number two, you care about having the exclusive right to use that name for what you do. And or three, you want to make money by licensing the name. If you fit into those categories, then you're a little concerned about this. But as we said, the outcome's far from certain. This is set up to be a battle royale. It's essentially power in Washington against the money. It's not clear how it will turn out, but a lot of people are watching.
As the outcome of the controversy appeared certain, President Obama honored Native American activist Susan Schoenharjo with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The fury over sports teams' so-called appropriation of American Indian culture spread to other teams. The Kansas City Chiefs and the Atlanta Braves began to feel the heat, and tempers erupted outside the Cleveland Indians games.
Change the name of your baseball team and change the logo.
You got three people protesting. Big deal. Go try. It's a caricature. Get over it. Get up. You think every Irish person rags on a Notre Dame logo?
As the controversy over cultural appropriation appeared to be reaching an apex, the Supreme Court announced a decision that would put an end to the entire legal debate.
The Redskins have this rock band to thank, the Slants. They've been fighting 8 years, ever since the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office refused their name on the basis that it was offensive.
In June 2017, the Supreme Court ruled that the offensive provision of the Lanham Act was unconstitutional.
The vote was unanimous. Justice Samuel Alito said it's not up to that government office to limit speech. It would constitute, quote, a huge and dangerous extension of the government speech doctrine.
So what does this mean for the Redskins? Their case is very similar.
The Supreme Court decision is clear that trademarks are private speech, not government speech. I don't see how the team loses after this case.
The Indian plaintiffs in the trademark lawsuit soon announced that they'd be dropping their case against the Redskins. the football team had won the legal battle.
Governor Dan Snyder said he was thrilled today. A Supreme Court decision will be a game changer for football teams' fight to keep its name.
As for the Redskins, while legally the win is on their side, the moral case isn't exactly a touchdown.
To the extent people are not happy with the name, and there are a lot of people who are that way, you're going to have to rely on public pressure and sort of court of public opinion to prevent this name from continuing to be used.
And that public pressure would come in 2020. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So after the Supreme Court ruled that the offensive provision of the Lanham Act was unconstitutional, the Redskins had finally won the legal battle over their name and logo.
To the extent people are not happy with the name, and there are a lot of people who are that way, you're going to have to rely on public pressure and sort of court of public opinion to prevent this name from continuing to be used.
And that public pressure would come in 2020.
Overnight, Minneapolis on fire. Protesters leaving an auto parts store in flames. Others seen looting a local Target.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
What?
Black Lives Matter!
They'd gathered hours before, furious at the death of 46-year-old George Floyd.
When is it really gonna change? When is it really gonna stop?
The outrage building nationwide.
With the death of George Floyd and the rise of BLM, a new kind of pressure was unleashed on the Washington Redskins.
One of the original NFL teams under mounting pressure to change its controversial name. The Washington Redskins, facing a new corporate and political push to scrap its name, widely viewed as a racial slur against Native Americans. FedEx, which owns the naming rights for the team's home stadium, requesting that the name given to the team in 1933 become a thing of the past. In a one-sentence statement, the delivery giant writing, "We have communicated to the team in Washington our request that they change the team name." Overnight, Nike appearing to remove all of the team's merchandise from its online store.
Washington, D.C. lawmakers also announced that the team could not relocate a new stadium if they didn't change their name. The political campaign against the Redskins that started in the 1980s had finally reached a tipping point.
One of the most controversial team names in sports history is being removed.
Tonight, Washington's NFL team buckling under pressure, dropping the Redskins' name and logo.
In the months that followed, others fell in line.
It was a common sight every opening day and at baseball games throughout the season. A small, relentless group of people would gather in protest, calling for the Indians to drop Chief Wahoo and find a new team name.
We're going to continue to keep coming out here until it's eliminated.
And finally, that day has come.
The Kansas City Chiefs will not be changing their name anytime soon. The organization's president said they are keeping it, but they are retiring their mascot, a horse named Warpaint.
The cultural appropriation floodgates had opened. The Native American activists understood that politics is downstream of culture. They had an almost complete victory.
When Adriana was asked at the Diggable Planets concert if she was a Muslim, she answered with her signature flair.
Not that it's any of your business, but I'm Catholic. You want me to say an Our Father for you?
If you're not a Muslim, then you shouldn't be wearing a kufi, the guy responded.
It's not a kufi. I got it at Judy's.
The two had an exchange for what seemed like a minute or so. Adriana made her case while I surveyed the building audience. As usual, she wasn't backing down.
I did not appreciate this guy trying to tell me what to do, or Patrick with that "I told you so" look on his face.
But in the end, I think we both saw the writing on the wall. I may have shut down a club a year earlier with a fit of rage, but one look at the building crowd and it was easy to see that we were wildly outnumbered.
So against my better judgment, I went to the bathroom and took off my adorable Judy's hat and tried to fix the gel-saturated mess that was my hair underneath it. To this day, I maintain that I was right, even though Patrick's prediction ended up coming true. And if I had to do it over again, I would have rather left the concert than take off the cute Judy's hat that was definitely not a kufi.
Which leads us back to the question, what is cultural appropriation?
Cultural appropriation is nothing but a power grab, carefully crafted by ethnic groups that have adopted a victim ideology, and it's used to keep their perceived opponents constantly on the defense. If we were to follow their twisted concept that cultural elements can only be used by the culture that created them, then only whites could skateboard, play baseball, and basketball, because each was invented by a white person. That would, of course, be wrong. When the Native Americans began their attack on the Redskins, aside from a small group of activists, there was no hue and cry about the name. They claimed their Native teenagers had the highest rate of suicide in the United States, and they tied that statistic directly to Native American references in sports. But from 1999 to 2017, after American Indian references had been drastically reduced in schools and sports, the CDC reported that the suicide rate increased among Native Americans by as much as 139%. It's almost as if the fight over cultural appropriation had nothing to do with what the activists were claiming.
And that's because it didn't. Cultural appropriation is nothing but a power grab by victim groups that want advantages embedded into the law. So if you're going to put a kufi on, keep it on in the face of their attacks, or they'll continue to cry victim until they get their way.
The larger question I think that we have to wrestle with in this conversation about cultural appropriation is, how do we change the rules in Hollywood and throughout many industries?
Be sure to visit our Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook page to let us know what you would have done in the Take Off That Kufi confrontation. Head over to RedPilledAmerica.com to find our social media pages.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Thanks for listening.